Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you today, Jody, to do this interview. And to get ourselves started, I'll ask you to give your name.
My name is Jody Lawrence Butman.
And the place and date of birth?
I was born in 1960, December 31st, in Fort William, McKellar Hospital.
Good. And then we'd like to get a sense of how you became involved in the grain trade. Now, you didn't work in elevators ever, I guess, but you did work that did relate to moving grain.
Yes, I did. I did not work in any of the elevators, actually, but I worked on a lot of the boats that carried the grain, different grains, and actually at the shipyards, they called it Pascal. And then I actually worked for Mr. Schaefer, his name was Paul Schaefer's dad, at Western Scrap Metal, it was called, disassembling the boats after they were finished. With use of transporting the grain.
Right. So you have repaired grain carriers, and you've taken grain carriers apart.
Yes, both, yes.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting.
Manufacturing and disassembling. Yeah.
Right. And you did this as a certified welder?
Yes, it was, yes. Yeah, I got my ticket at Conn College, a two-year course. I think I was around 18 or 19 years old. I acquired that.
Mm-hmm. So this was...
Yeah, it was something that happened because I wasn't... I didn't finish my... my diploma from high school, and I was kind of wondering where I was going to go, and some friends had started taking the course, so I thought I'd do something, and I got into it, and I liked it, and then I finished top of my class, and from there it just took off. The first place I did work was as a welder was at the shipyard.
Right, so you went from Confederation College straight off to the shipyard to begin welding there.
Mm-hmm. And I worked there... 2 winters and 3 summers, and mm-hmm. it was a type of job that was sporadic because of the seasonal work of the grain elevator, the grain because of the grain movement. Eh?
Yeah, well, you might say something about the seasonality of
right,
it.
Right.
You were involved in repairing ships there,
yeah.
And so this would take place.
Most of the time, it took place in the winter time. They would get the ship in whatever ship it was, whether it was Patterson lines or CSL lines or there was a couple other ones that I can't remember recall now, but
and Meisner, they would Meisner by any chance? Meisner?
Yeah, Meisner was there too. Yeah, they would pull one into the dry dock and then assess the damage and then start to repair the damage as it went along. Sometimes summer work for sure too.
Mm-hmm.
Different seasonal work, and as a welder, it was the extremes of the hot and the cold played on you because of the apparel that you had to wear at the time.
Yeah. I'll say.
To protect yourself.
You'd be working inside ships.
Inside, underneath.
In dry dock, I see.
Underneath the dry dock, yeah, underneath. Like, they would settle that boat on, similar as you would jack your car up and put timbers underneath, but they had the schematic of the boat, the underside of the boat, and they would place the blocks in certain positions and then float the boat in and settle it in the center of it and pump the water on it. It would settle onto the blocks. So you had about 4 feet underneath the boat that you could walk from one underneath to the other underneath the boat.
You have to duck under.
Yeah, you could crawl right underneath, yeah, and then they would assess the damage and they would cut the bottom damage out. Usually what happened was the boats would be run aground on sandbars out wherever they were coming from, and it would rip the hull open, and it would stop them from taking on the ballast water that they could, so they wouldn't list one way or the other when they had the grain in them. So
were these ship double hulled? Was there an inner lining holding
yes.
the grain and then
oh, yes. Yes.
The area between?
That was the ballast tanks, eh?
The ballast tanks
to keep it from listing one way or the other. Right. If you had grain, so much grain in one hold, you had to have so much water in another in the other sides of the boats to mm-hmm. keep it from going. So they all had it all figured out that way. So if one ballast was ripped open because of the sandbar, they would have to repair that part.
I see. Yeah. How many ballast... Now, the ships you were... repairing would be what length?
730 feet long.
That's the canal length, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. Most of them were 730 feet long.
Yeah.
There was not too many that were longer than that. The dry dock wouldn't take much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. It was built for the old canal trade, I guess.
Yeah, and there, the ones that were bigger than that, they would pull them up along the side,
mm-hmm.
and they would just do more top damage and side damage and side panels and things like that and whatever else, engine room work that they did. Because they did a lot of different things at Pasco. They did manufacturing, they did machinering, everything, all the motors and everything.
So. Well, they had a terrific woodworking shop,
yeah.
which I have visited yeah. back in
you
the
did.
80s.
I never got a chance to go into that.
Oh, did you?
But I was in the foundry
where they
forged a lot of the different things and all the brass and stuff. And later in the years, I know that some of this, a lot of the stuff come over from overseas, from Sweden and places like that. They would ship in the propellers and the shafts and things like that for the motors.
Which once upon a time had been manufactured there, I suppose.
Yes, at one time it was, yeah. But they just didn't have the facilities, I guess, left anymore. They would make certain stuff, but not the big things.
I imagine, too, there just wasn't enough of it to keep the crews and the equipment up and so on.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess just like everything has to ship, they have to farm it out to somewhere, right?
Right.
But the propellers themselves were probably one shaft of the propeller would be probably close over 10 feet long, one piece of the prop. And the nuts to hold them on, they were all made of this material called chromoly. And the one nut was probably almost 18 inches around, one nut to put onto the bolt. And they would tighten it up with the crane. They would use a chain fall, and then to get it really tight, the overhead crane would come along and pull up on the chain and keep turning the wrench to tighten the bolt up. It was amazing to watch. I never got involved in that, but I got to watch it. I got to watch that. So.
There would be interesting things to do.
Oh, incredible.
How many ballast tanks would a 730?
Offhand, I wouldn't know how many. I believe the ballast tanks were that we worked in were probably 20 feet long, and they were about 4 feet wide, and you could hop from one to another, and then there would be the bulkhead. So they were usually joined by in two pieces. So probably 40 feet long by.
So there were somewhere two of them. I guess it's 80 and a 730 would be what, over 9/8 or.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how. And then as they got to the front, they narrowed, and they changed dimensions as they got to the front. Yeah.
Was this repairing then of the bottom of the ship, the ballast tank tanks that had been torn open? Was that the main welding repair that you did?
That and side damage. On the side damage, they take a whole panel out, probably about a 20 foot by 20 foot piece of steel out that had been damaged. They'd hit something. I don't know how they would hit the sides, but they would run into something, and the steel was inch thick, and they would take that out, and then the welder and the fitter would dog it into place with the dogs and wedges, and then we weld it, tack it, and then tack it on the day shift, and then the night shift would come in and totally weld it up,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't want the fitter was always on the day shift because of the welding flashes and things like that. So the night shift crew would come in and the fitters wouldn't be around,
mm-hmm.
so they could weld steady.
You've used a bit of technical language there for our lay listeners.
Okay, sorry.
To dog something.
In the a dog is just like it has a it's a wedge with a they weld the one piece onto the plate that they're putting in that they're putting into place, and then it actually they weld the one piece onto the hull of the boat.
Right.
Right. They put the piece of steel in there, and then they put a wedge in between the piece of the steel that's going in and the dog, so it wedges it into place, and then they tack it all around different spots every foot, and then at night shift they'll come in and they'll zip it up.
Would the piece of steel that was being put in be cut at port ship? Or?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Down on the bottom. Sometimes they would have to weld two pieces together, and they would use a machine called a submersed arc, And it was a welding machine that was on a track, and they would put two 20-foot pieces of steel together, and they would bevel the both end, the both sides, and set the track up along that joint, and the submerged arc, the arc would be underneath flux, and this submerged arc machine would travel along the track at a certain speed. You could regulate it by dials on the machine.
Computerized,
yeah, and it would weld a perfect weld, and it'd run past over top, and so it'd become stronger than the metal itself all the time. And
submerged meaning the underside.
You couldn't see the arc.
Right.
It would be infused underneath in the flux, so it was totally clean. There was no impurities in the weld at all.
Right.
Once you get an impurity in the weld, that's a weak
it's
spot.
It's a weakness. It would be.
And you don't need that in the middle of the water, I don't think.
No. And so would it be welded just on the one side, or would it be turned to be welded?
They would flip on the other side too.
And do the other side.
Yeah.
So this was the intention then, was to take two pieces of steel and make them as strong as if it had been
make
one piece of steel.
Make them stronger and make them bigger, yeah. So that, they could do the patch.
Right.
They could do one patch, big patch at the same time instead of two smaller ones.
And the sort of tacked into place, I suppose one might say, during the daytime? Or was
yes.
It, and then what was the reason for the final weld, the complete job to be done during the night?
Well, at nighttime, it was mainly because of the fitters would, there would be no welding flashes. If you have a person welding a vertical joint that's 20 foot long, he's continuously welding on that for hours.
Yes.
And so the welding flash is there all the time. And the
light, it's flash from the
arc. The arc itself, yeah. If you have the worst flash is from the side. People think it's on straight on, but it's from the side. So you have peripheral vision, and it'll give you a flash, which is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, this is where you wear the wraparound goggles and so on too.
Yes, but if in the day shift there was doing that, the fitters wouldn't be provided with that stuff. They were just fitters. So at nighttime they do a 4 to 12 shift, and then a 12-8 shift all night. They'd be running all night sometimes, and cold.
One of the stories I remember from my father's telling, he taught himself how to weld in the 50s on the farm, and eventually ran a welding shop in Carman, Manitoba for a time. But he told us this story about some kid who, or young fellow who was curious to watch the welding, and just with his naked eyes watched it for a time.
Mm.
And in the evening he was standing outside facing the wind, trying to cool his eyes because he'd done...
It's like
it's
similar to having sand in your eyes. I've had many flashes. When I was welding, many flashes, and it's just like having sand in your eyes. There's nothing you can do. Well, I guess they put a neosporin in your eyes at the hospital, but they're quite uncomfortable. It goes away after a day and a half or so.
But too much of this would do damage to the eye.
I would imagine so.
Yeah,
it's be similar to looking at the sun for a long time. That's what the equivalent.
Yes, of course.
To, yeah. Similar to looking at the sun for a period of time, the ultraviolet rays.
How long would it take to weld in it? So this is a piece that is, 20 feet wide?
20 foot by probably 20 foot. Good square piece
a
most
square
of the
piece.
Time. How long would it take to do
weld
that?
Weld it all?
Oh.
All night?
Oh, longer than that. A couple of days to weld a piece like that. And you'd have more than one welder on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'd have a couple welders on the doing the horizontal, and then a couple guys doing the vertical, and then... Most of the time, the foreman would know who was better at doing one position than the other, because one is harder than the other. The vertical is harder. It's a harder position to weld. They want the better welders on that one.
So the tricky thing is that both are vertical surfaces, aren't they? It's not like having something lying on a table where you're welding.
The flat weld is the easiest weld. You can't really... mess that one up, but it's the vertical or the overhead weld that's the hard one.
Yes, and laying down a clean bead and maintaining that bead and so on.
The damage in the side tanks where the ballasts were was the most dirtiest and the hardest stuff to weld, because they'd be trying to fit on the outside. They would have two really pretty good piece of metal to weld, so there's no impurities. They would clean it up really good. The fitter would clean it up, but in the side tanks, it was welding new metal, patching it into old rusty steel, you know, so you'd have to clean it up as best you can. And sometimes there'd be water running down, because when you put heat to things in the middle of winter, things start to melt, so water starts to trickle down, and you're doing overheads over your head, and water's trickling down. I can remember getting a good poke from the electricity, because the water is trickling down, and you,
yeah,
it's just, and I really learned how to weld there.
I bet.
Yeah, more than at the college.
Of course.
I learned techniques, but I learned how to weld there. Yeah. Poured a lot of rod. They would pour a, in a night shift, you would pour burn a whole box of rod would be about that big, about that long, a good, 50 pounds of rod one night.
Yeah, the rods tend to run, were they a foot long? Or?
Yeah, close to a foot long. And a little longer, yeah. Little longer.
And they vary in thickness.
They vary in thickness for their tensile strengths and their different properties that they run, their fluxes on the outside, mm-hmm. and different positions that you can run them in, and different techniques that you can do with the rod.
So in this case, you were welding good steel.
Most of the time, yeah.
Although the joints must sometimes, as you're saying, when you've got rusted and. Corroded, that means that the thickness has been affected. It's not the full thickness
any longer.
Yeah,
absolutely. And they, in those instances, there wasn't much that they could do, really.
No.
You can't replace the whole thing. They would just patch it until, I guess, the lifelong of the boat would
reach the point where...
it's no repair, like an old car. You can't do much more to it. But
so removing the opening, the hole was involved. Cutting with a welder as well, I suppose.
Well, with a torch, yeah. They would come along. We'd cut the piece out that you needed to.
And you were
first of all, we'd cut an access hole for the inspectors to go in, mm-hmm. The welding inspectors, and he would go in and he would mark with a special marking pen, and he would mark what needs to be cut out, what needs to be replaced, and the guy would go in and cut it all out and make the bigger access hole, and then bring in the new steel and tack it into mm-hmm. place. Yeah.
The inspector was an employee of the shipyard?
Oh, yeah. So. Alongside, I guess, with the white hats would come in, the foremen would come in, and I'm not sure if there was a an employee of the, CSL or mm-hmm. with them or
yeah,
not.
Just I'm just wondering,
sure.
Or whether, you don't know whether they were government employees.
Yeah, or insurance.
Or insurance.
Insurance, yeah. There would probably be some kind of insurance.
Although in the first order.
Adjusters in there.
I would think in the first order, deciding what needed to... Well, it could be insurance adjuster who would come in and say how much has to be cut out here to make the repair.
I remember the big insurance company was Lloyd's of London.
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course.
They were huge. So.
They've been at it for a long time.
Yeah. Right? And they were one of the biggest ones that would take on that sort of insurance, I guess.
How long would a repair of that sort take from the time that the hole is cut and the inspector comes in and...
Well, most of those boats would come in, and if it was in for the winter, it was in for the whole winter. Mm-hmm. It would stay there, and it would be done upright. So there'd be a lot of damage to a job like that. The ones that were lesser damage, they would do them in the summertime, so they could get them in and out. Because mm-hmm. once she's in the wintertime, the freeze is outside. You can't get it. You can't get it out again.
Yeah, managing a. A dry dock really involves deciding which ship is going to have the dry dock for the winter.
Absolutely. So you would get ones that needed more damage and a lot of engine work. And mm-hmm. And then there were times when I worked in the engine room, and I often wondered about those times where we would be... In the engine room, there was a lot of asbestos on the pipe, covering the pipes and stuff like that, and I often wonder about those times that I did... Back then, there was no big talk of the asbestos scare that there is now.
They still didn't have you with face masks.
No, they had nothing.
And, and the asbestos was floating in the air?
Oh, it was floating. It was everywhere. We would cut it off, cut it off and rip it off with our hands.
Yeah.
No, there was no talk of safety at all back then. No, not that kind of safety. Anyways. No, and so you rip it off, and then you take the torch and cut the piece of pipe out or the hangers out. And take it out, and then we put a new pipe back in.
No, that's distressing. This is only 30 or so years ago, and problems with asbestos were known in the 70s, weren't they? I think Johns Manville went into bankruptcy protection, I think it was in the 70s, because of lawsuits to
that whole asbestos scare and that whole asbestos mining thing and the mining. It is really scary stuff.
Oh, it is.
It is. But it's a necessary mineral. They still use it today in certain things.
Well, I'm not sure to what extent, but certainly it has been used a lot.
Yes.
In contexts in which, as in brake drum.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
shoes on the old drum brakes were certainly asbestos.
Still,
so when you think of the stuff, the asbestos that slowly must have flaked off from that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the question is of dust, isn't it? If it's asbestos fiber in water, as there was a concern down near the taconite plants in Minnesota some years ago in water, the problem is the lungs, isn't it?
Yes.
The stuff gets in
myo,
the lungs.
What do they call that? Myosotopus?
It's something like that. I don't have the name at the tip of my tongue, but it is a...
I often wonder that sometimes. I'm not a smoker, but I have sometimes a cough and everything, so...
Yeah.
But there was a lot of guys that did that work, so...
Sure. Well, it's a time bomb, and we wish you well with with that in your lungs if it's there. So the... and in the engine room, it would be a matter then of replacing pipes, primarily?
Steam pipes, replacing whatever needs to be replaced. If turbines, motors need to be replaced, we usually just cut the brackets off that held the things that held them in place, and then we'd be re-welding them into place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just alongside the steam maker or or the fitter or whoever it was, or the electrician. They all had their own.
Yes,
it was a very unionized place. If you couldn't touch somebody else's job, if you needed an electrician to change a light bulb, you weren't changing light bulbs there. The electrician had to come along and change light bulbs. And the carpenter, if you didn't touch nail and hammer there, it just wasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
It was very unionized because you were cutting the other man's throat by doing it.
Yeah.
And that's what the... So.
Yeah, there's language for this sort of collective agreement. But,
yes.
I don't remember it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it...
There's derogatory language, of course, as well, with companies and managements wanting freedom to move workers around, or just to have one person do everything, rather than, as you say, protecting the jobs of your fellow members. Yeah, is United Steel Workers Local...
I'm not sure what it is 40? Anymore. Yeah, I was belonged to for quite a while.
Well,
nowadays they have millwrights, so millwrights can do pretty much most things. They do all those things.
From your memory, what were the different job classifications? You've named three by this time,
there
I guess.
Was,
the
okay,
electrician, the carpenter, obviously the welder.
Welder, there was a fitter.
The fitters, that's four.
Carpenter. Then there were the laborers.
But what would the laborers do in these circumstances? The laborer wouldn't change a light bulb.
Move scaffolding.
Okay.
They would move the scaffolding. Pulling cable for the welding machines. Cleaning up. Garbage. Fire watch. There was fire watch. You always had the fire watch. Wherever there was welding, you had the fire watch.
Mm-hmm,
had to be a personal extinguisher all the time on there. And saying that, I wasn't working at the shipyards at the time that this happened. I was working somewhere else.
At another workplace?
I was working at Kankar. I was welding at Kankar after the shipyards. And a friend of mine passed away there. They were in one of the side tanks, and it exploded as a result of oxyacetylene.
Yeah, this is quite an infamous event.
This
particular, there were two or three.
Yes, one was a friend of mine. His name was Gary McDonald.
Yeah, was there a fellow named Osadic?
I'm not sure the other two guys. I remember the one guy. I would have known them probably, but I knew the one guy well. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
And do you think it could have been avoided, that particular accident?
Well, I'll say this on this tape, and if you want edit this part, that's fine by me. But could it have been avoided? I would think so. At the shipyards, back in those days, and I'm not sure if it goes on anymore, alcohol and drugs were very prolific. And on a night shift, at any given time, it was all around. And was that young man that I knew high? Probably. Could it have been avoided? Probably. If he had been more coherent and more attuned to his job.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that that was the case, but I knew him well.
So there was a culture of
yes.
Of alcoholism or of alcohol consumption during the
absolutely.
Night?
We would go to the we would go to the Jolly Roger at lunchtime.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they give you a pass out. The company itself at the gate would give you a pass to go out for the lunch and come back. And then nothing was said, and lots of things went on during the day.
Even during the day.
In the yard. At a night shift at 12 to 8,
yeah.
People would bring in brandy to keep warm.
Or so the argument was.
So the argument was.
Because, of course, liquor doesn't do it. Actually warm you. It just gives you the sensation.
Not at 40 below. It doesn't. No, it sucks the heat right out of you.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, and I was part of that. I was all part of that, for sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did it change? Were you employed there after this accident, or had you finished there?
I had finished there. No, I don't think I ever went back there after that. No, I went on to...
Did you have friends working there after?
Oh, yes.
And did they say things had changed after?
No, I never. I don't know. I never talked to them about that, but I don't think so. You know, no. I don't think so. I mean, no. I.
You know Tom Chauvin?
Yes.
We've interviewed Tom once, so we need to listen to that tape because he's now retired.
Right.
And Tom was happy to talk further, but I.
Tommy was not a welder. Tommy was. Foreman at the end of Pitty? Was he fitter?
Well, he became president of the local for a long time.
Right. Yes, he was president. He was a steward or whatever.
He could have been the union steward.
Union steward when I was there, that's right. Yeah. But I can't remember his classification. He still had to have a classification back.
He would have
when
had
he worked.
To. Sure.
Yeah.
He would have had a job,
have to have a job
in the first
yes.
order. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, things to ask Tommy about when... We
oh, I'm sure he's seen
some more.
I'm sure he probably turned his head to.
Well, I think my memory from the last interview was that he suggested that he had become more concerned about these things, and
mm-hmm.
that I think
mm-hmm.
they'd stopped turning their heads, averting their eyes from what was going on, because it's so dangerous to have people who aren't in full control of their senses.
And it's not only dangerous; it affects so many people's lives. It affected every person. It affected mine by listening to what happened to that young man. He was a friend, and he had family, and he had all kinds of people. And could it have been avoided? Absolutely, could have been avoided. Absolutely, you're dealing with heavy machinery. You have 240 volts of electricity running through your hand. And if you have alcohol or drugs in you, it's not a good thing.
No.
It's not. And, you know, and then he was a fire watcher. He was supposed to be watching that job.
Mm-hmm.
There's two other men that were doing their job.
Can I ask you, when you came into Portship, was this an atmosphere in which substance abuse... grew for you, or had you been familiar?
No, I had already been introduced to it.
Yeah, so it wasn't any change that took place.
No, it was
I mean, alcohol is the most common drug in the around the globe. I think still.
Yes, it's very socially accepted, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but people turn a blind eye to it because, well, it's socially accepted.
Well, it gradually changed at workplaces. It's
slowly.
Surfaced in other interviews we've done that I think in the last 20 years or so.
Yes, it has changed. It has changed in my workplace. I'd like to see it change in other places. I'd love to see it change in our city employees.
I'm getting a little more delicate here, so we
better
should
watch.
Go back back to Portship. Maybe.
All right, let's go.
Or have you worked for the city?
No, I haven't.
How many welders would there have been at the time you were working?
On a shift, welders on a shift, well, there'd be on one shift probably 50 at like one shift, and you had three shifts. And then it all depended on the type of boat.
Sure.
Yeah, so... There wasn't only just damaged boats come in. We actually got a chance to work on a new boat. We actually got a chance to build a new boat, build one half of a boat.
So it was the Aird?
John Beard.
So you, that, it was that late, was it? No, around 1980, early 80s when the Aird was put together.
Yes. So that's when, what they did was, it's just memories like that. It's hard to come back. But we built the one half, and we put
the front half,
that's right. Yeah. We put a false bulkhead on it, and they floated it down to Collingwood, and they joined the two together.
Yeah. Collingwood built the back half. The engine.
Yes.
And all the rest.
Yeah, because we didn't have the facilities to founder the engine and all that. So I wonder if the John Beard's in service still.
I don't know offhand. I visited Collingwood about 86 or 7, so just a few years when I was MP, years later.
Yeah.
And of course, that construction was one that they were proud of as well, since they built the half, and then the two halves were mated. Mm-hmm. And
so our half wasn't. Our half had no accommodations on it. They built the part with the accommodations. Our part was strictly grain holes and the bulkheads. And
the Aird was bigger than a canaler, am I right? Or was it a canal?
That's right, it was, because that's why we could only do the one half, I guess, but not in the engine work. But I mean, it was a bigger boat. I'm not sure exactly.
And you
I believe it was a 1,000 footer.
I think
it was a 1,000 footer. Yeah.
So you built about 500 feet.
Yes.
Were you involved yourself in that building?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Must have been quite exciting to build a ship.
It was exciting to see the technology that went into it, for it to go across the lake with the rough weather and stuff. Yeah. You know, like the thickness of the plate steel varied from the center to the end of the ship, both ends, because of the roll of the wave, and the boat had to give a certain amount or else she would split in half. So the center of the ship was almost 3 inches thick, the plate on the top,
the deck plate
down to the box, down to each end.
It had a bit of a natural slope to it.
It didn't have the slope.
No.
You couldn't really, well, I guess you're right. I guess
very good
to the water to roll off. But the idea was so it would give certain amounts and would roll.
Some flex to it.
Yeah, some flex to it. The technology in that, I don't know.
Which parts of the Aird did you weld on yourself today? Clearly, you know the deck.
Yeah, all different pieces. Parts. I couldn't really, all different parts. We were put in different parts every day. It was different, depending on how your welding capabilities were and that. So.
Yeah, that's, of course, another part of this, the 50 welders. Were there rankings amongst
yes,
the
there
welders?
Was. Yes, there was, yes.
Was the company welders maintained?
Yes, it was all company maintained, yeah. And you had to have so many hours, and then they would give you a promotion on from, and I think it was AB welders, that's what it was. And they had a test that they give you, when you first started, they give you a test to see where you fit in, right?
You had a weld, I suppose.
Yeah, so they give you, they're not going to hire you if you don't know how to weld, so they give you a test. And you did your own CWB test at the college, so that told you you could weld. It didn't really give you much.
CWB.
It just told you, Canadian Welding Board, I think that's what it would stand for.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and then
there'd be a certifying body.
Each company that you worked for give you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there were just the two ranks then, were you suggesting?
Yeah.
So you're sort of a apprentice or journeyman welder, and then I guess a master welder.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there wasn't so much time related. It was to some extent in terms of the length of time you welded.
They would leave the A welders alone by themselves. And to weld the stuff that they wanted, more intricate work. The tacking of the plate steel was more of a B welder's job.
Mm-hmm.
So you would work yourself, unless you were on day shift or what, and they needed somebody or whatever.
Like sure.
Yeah.
But then the final welding in would be done by A welder.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course, the thing has to be waterproof.
Mm-hmm.
How was the weld tested at all?
Yeah, they would X-ray the tests.
They X-rayed them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would X-ray test certain pieces of welds, not all the weld, because it would be impossible to X-ray all the welds. So they would X-ray it to the standard of the insurance company, I would imagine, to whatever they.
How do you X-ray a weld?
I never seen it. I never seen it do them do it, but I know that they
presumably
did.
A plate on one side or the other, and
yeah,
I suppose perhaps on the inside.
And what they look for is porosity.
Yeah.
They look for holes that are not pure. So right there, they'll know if there's a bunch of porosity, that's where it's going to break.
Sure.
Because the welder's supposed to be stronger than the steel itself.
Mm-hmm.
The tensile strength.
Yeah, the weld wouldn't have tensile strength, would it?
The rod that you're putting into it, would have it has
tensile
a certain tensile
is strength that allows for flexing, is it? Whereas
now
the
you
weld...
got me. Now you got back way back for that one, my schooling for that one. But I know that each rod had a certain tensile strength. Most of them 40,000 pounds per square inch. And some are 70,000 pounds per square inch, depending on the rod itself. But
well, I'm completely a bystander here, which
yeah,
is kind of
yeah.
guessing at these things, aside from the fact that I've watched my dad weld and attempted to tell a story or two, but not on the tape, about all of that.
Yeah. You know, once you start to weld, you put all those things in the background. They're all in the back of my head, you know. And I just know that now that I could stick two pieces of metal together pretty good.
Yeah. If they're the right kind of material.
The right kind of material and cleanliness, and they have to be clean for sure, you know.
The thickness is a factor, isn't it?
Absolutely. There are
the thinner
factors.
Steel is, the
harder,
worse.
Harder, a little tougher.
And then, of course, you have other kinds of metals that
yes.
are very, very difficult to weld.
Yes, some are different, some positions.
Cast iron pieces particularly, but I won't get into that. So you worked at Portship then for the 2 winters you said?
Two winters and three summers.
Three summers. How did you enjoy working at Portship?
I liked it. I really liked it. The money was good. The money was really good. For a young fella, the money was good.
I guess the money's the same no matter. It isn't age determined or experience determined particularly. Once you're an A welder, that's the wage for the 40 years
pretty
or whatever
much.
Length
that's
of time
right,
you're there.
As you graduate up the scale through the union contract or whatever it was.
And there were older guys in the place,
lots
I'm
older,
sure.
Lots of older, younger guys. There were a lot of guys my age coming out of school. They wanted the young guys too and bringing them up in the company. And there were some older guys that were there for a long time.
In the early 80s, Portship was still operating at a good or high...
They were a good employer.
Economic
they
level,
were a good employer. I would imagine they probably. I'm just guessing at this, speculating. I would guess there were 400 people, 400 people employed there, which was probably a pretty good.
Yeah, I can imagine it.
I would think
be.
That there would be that many people. Yeah.
And all of this, of course, is before the grain trade through Thunder Bay took a bit of a because you finished in 1980.
Yeah.
Two,
not,
three
I'm,
or
yeah,
so?
Yeah, somewhere around there. I'm not sure exactly the dates. Those are all sketchy on me.
I was thinking I would have met you at plant gating at Portship, but you probably were over at Cancar by that time.
Probably, yeah. And I didn't work there
by
too long either.
By the time I was running in 84.
Yeah. I didn't work at Cancar too long. So.
The winter work was brutal, I guess.
Oh, yes. Beyond brutal. It was cold. You had to wear steel-toe boots. So that's not a good cold, and you couldn't get enough clothes on you, really. Sometimes in the side tanks, which was probably against company policy for sure, we would let the acetylene tank run in the corner. We would wire it up, and we'd turn it on, and we'd let it go. Just to heat it up.
Generate some heat.
They wouldn't give me any heat, other than the light bulbs that were running through the side tanks.
Yeah.
And you would sit, and you would weld.
Yes.
And you'd make sure that you were dressed really warm.
Was there any recognition of the difficulty of doing a good job in those kinds of conditions?
No, you got paid.
The company didn't?
No, not really. I think that the recognition that some welders got was if the welding supervisors seen that you were a go-getter, you know, if you were, you didn't take breaks and all those things, yeah, you would get the better jobs. You would get the better jobs. That's recognition, I guess.
Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking of recognition in terms of what you got, but in terms of whether the company realized, I guess is what I mean, what the circumstances were and could do anything. Of course, I guess those you couldn't have heated ballast tanks in the wintertime. Just you were out of the wind.
Yes, you're out of the wind.
But
you were most out of the wind, but down in the bulkheads underneath the boat
in
there.
The bowels of
the bowels of the ship. And the wind would howl down the dry dock. Yeah,
yeah.
Ash would come down, and it would come in. Oh, you're out of the wind a bit. You're beside the lake, right at the lake. Cold. It was much colder place than that. And you're in steel.
Yes.
Steel.
Which
steel.
transmits all the heat out.
It's not forgiving. Not very forgiving. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And shifts were 8 hours?
Yeah, 8-hour shifts, yeah.
And coffee breaks?
Yeah, coffee breaks. We had a good lunchroom. We had a nice, big, warm lunchroom. We'd play crib during our breaks.
And so you got to walk into the lunchroom from the ship and then climb back out.
On your way out, on your way out to the ship, go to your spot where you're welding, you'd go and get rods from the rod oven, and they'd be warm for a while. You stick them in your rod pouch and go out. Because once they get cold, they don't weld too well. They don't burn too well.
So. Oh, really?
Yeah, they hold them in a rod oven that keeps them to a certain temperature.
I see.
Or else the flux breaks off when you get them to the boat.
And you have the stimulant in a side pocket, I suppose, as far as cooling or warming the throat and so on.
Yes. Yes.
I suppose in those circumstances, the certain amount of alcohol gets oxidized fairly quickly, probably not enough of it.
Was it the right thing? No, it wasn't the right thing. But it was just something.
Would there have been an alternative? Could you have had electric suits that would have warmed you? Would have been expense involved in that kind of equipment.
We wore leathers. We wore leather chaps. We wore leather pants and leather jackets. It was all leather. You were covered in leather from one to the top. Mm-hmm. And whatever
because
else
of sparks.
Sparks. Yeah. Lots of burns. And you'd be welding an overhead, and it would sometimes go down your neck.
Yeah.
And it would go all the way down. So you had so many layers of clothes on, and it would go down, and you couldn't do nothing about it.
No.
Because at the time you got...
Until it cooled.
By the time you have your stuff off to get it, it's burned into your skin anyways.
Yeah.
So you'd have lots of burns. The worst ones would go down into your boot, and they'd go into your boot, and they'd stay in there, and you'd just have to put up with the rattle your leg around
until
and look at it after, you know?
Yeah.
And take care of it after, because you're in the cold, you couldn't do that, really. You couldn't take your boots off.
Electric welding, you're always, the sparks are always spraying away.
Yeah.
And any opening is likely to...
And then the water comes, and it spurts off, and throws the arc off, and slags falling everywhere in your hair, burning your hair. You know, we always had a hard on, but I don't know why those get in there. So.
Well, if you're welding upward at all, I mean, it's going to be open, isn't it, to some extent, and so on.
Yeah, did I like it? Yeah, I liked it. I do like the weld. I do still like the weld.
But Cancar was an improvement in terms of conditions.
Yes. Warmth, for sure.
Yeah, you were inside all the weldings
rigs,
in the building.
Yeah. I didn't like it there, though. Well, I had to get out of there. I didn't like the indoor part of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because of?
The smoke.
The smoke, so the air. Yeah. So we didn't have adequate ventilation.
The smoke not the freedom of too many supervisors around, too many people watching over your shoulder, doing everything that you did, scrutinizing everything.
Was it necessary?
Micromanagement? I don't think so.
Yeah.
No. I think there was no trust in a person's job.
How long did you work there?
I just worked 1 year, almost 1 year there.
I
was there with, actually, I was there, this is interesting, because what we were building there was the Saskpool hopper cars.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So Bombardier built hopper cars?
Yes,
as well.
They built the Saskpool hopper cars, the ones that you see with the big wheat thing on them.
Of course.
The big
yeah.
Wheat. Yeah, we built those, and I was on a part of the, I was right at the beginning of the line. The frame would come in with the wheels on it, and
I was called the undercarriage.
Yeah, and I was called the wrap up, and the sheets of steel would come in, and they would be fitted into the bottom of the frame, and then this machine would roll them up, and we would weld the bulkhead there.
The end of it.
Yeah, the end. Yeah.
And that was your job.
Yeah.
And of course, it was an assembly line. The cars moved, and so your job was always one more bulkhead.
So it would continue on down the line. We'd do a 15-foot vertical weld, all continuous, nonstop, because you couldn't have it stop. They didn't want it to stop because porosity, and they wanted it all continuous.
Right.
I still see those cars today.
Sure. Well, you built them well.
I guess the company did well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, we won't pursue the matter of wasting money on superfluous management.
No.
Which you suggested.
Yeah.
But, well, that's another aspect of the grain trade, quite clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long, do you know how long they built those cars, or how many they did?
I believe they only did it the 1 year. I'm assuming those. Yeah. I believe it was only the 1 year that they did those. They moved on to something else.
This is a new feature, and we've interviewed various people. I don't think that building these hopper cars in Thunder Bay has been mentioned by anyone else. In fact, we now have a reason to talk to people at CanCar too. I guess it worked in the early 80s.
Yeah, you get.
So I was aware that hopper cars have been built, I think, by Nova Scotia, whatever it was called, the successor to Dosco many years ago, I think built some. Sydney Steel, I guess, would be the company that did it.
Yeah.
I think they had contracts already in the 70s to do that. Mm. I think others were built probably in Hamilton, if I remember correctly.
I'm not sure. I'm intrigued to hear. How about Trenton?
Trenton, would be another of the car works that would have produced them. So they got a contract here, didn't
they? Trenton had, I remember Trenton did all the undercarriage, all the wheels, forging, all that, and that would all come down here, and we'd do the wrap-up here.
And you were doing the superstructure, if you will, the grain-holding part of it.
If you look at the cars, there's not much to the cars, really, other than the undercarriage.
Really. No.
They fill them up on the top, and they empty them on the bottom with the chute.
In fact, I guess the undercarriage would have the emptying equipment and so on, the chutes and so on and so on. That was already all there. You were getting the chassis, in effect, and putting the car body on the top to use the
car. And then they roll down the line, and they paint them there, too.
Sure.
They paint them all.
Including the Sasspool.
Including the Sasspool with the nice weed on there. Yeah. There.
Yep. Well. Another aspect.
Mm-hmm.
There was a social life to things at Port Chip as well, I suppose?
Yes. A huge social life. Everybody got along pretty good. All the welders, we would stick together. And social life comes in, then we'd go to the bar all together all the time. We'd party together. Some of us lived together for a long time. And then after shipyards, we went on to construction careers too, most of us. And we would see each other from time to time in construction, in different places, different towns, Dryden, wherever.
Right. As far as unions were concerned, there you were members of the Steelworkers Union, and everyone in the plant was a steelworker, I guess, whether they were laborers.
Yes.
Yeah, everyone. Everybody. So that was one of the ways of maintaining job classifications, I suppose, as well.
It was a tight union. It was strong. It was a pretty strong union.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you remember union meetings?
Yeah. Yes, at the labor center. Absolutely.
Any contract negotiations during the time you were there?
No, I don't. I don't recall that at all. No. You know, I was young and I didn't. Did I care about that stuff? No, not really. No.
You're grateful other people were, I suppose.
Was I then?
Yeah.
No, I didn't really think of that. I knew I got paid. Yeah. I did a job. I got paid. Right. You know. Did I get involved in the union stuff? Not really. So.
Did you ever have a grievance to pursue? Or?
That's interesting.
You would have had you in touch with the steward, for example, I suppose.
Had I ever talked to Mr. Chauvin? I know Tom. I remember him. He probably wouldn't remember me, but I remember him. I don't recall having anything to grieve about.
So everything went well with management?
I tried to do my job the best I could and stay out of the way best I could.
And you're suggesting that Port Chip had an appropriate level of supervision, too, in terms of the men watching the wells and so on and so forth. You were
that micro. That I would probably at Port Ship. I would probably say no to that. Not enough.
Not enough.
There wasn't enough of them, and the ones that they had, were they qualified to do the job? I don't know. You know, it's similar to hockey players. You either are a hockey player or you're a coach. You know, you don't make good hockey players coaches. So Do you make good welders, foremans? Or do you? No. You keep them as welders.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I dare say, if you
the ones
really
that can't weld very well, you put them in a position that...
Supervise.
Yes, that happens. No, I've seen that happen quite often. So.
The Peter principle promoted to your level of incompetence. Or the highest level. Well, it's incompetence, isn't it? Once you're not able to do a job, you don't get promoted any higher than
yes.
that.
Yes. I guess so, yeah. Isn't Why would you take a really good welder off of a job that you're getting production off of?
Yes. Was there an understanding amongst you of some real crackerjack welders
yes.
in your crew?
Yes, you always knew the ones that were better welders than other ones, and you always knew the ones that were, well, I don't know what technical word we could use for it, but brown nosers? That's not a very good word. But
well, it's a common one.
It's a common one. Yeah. So we always had those. Were those? Were those cast out from by the rest? Yes, yes.
Sort of ostracized.
Yes, we wouldn't want to associate with that.
No,
because you couldn't trust people like that.
No,
in a union mentality, you couldn't trust that. Mm-hmm. No way.
I mean, so were there guys who were sort of pushed out of the workplace altogether?
Yeah.
Then
I'm not sure about that, but there was a definite line, Mr. Ernie. There was a definite line between union and company there.
Yeah, of course.
A definite line. It was drawn in the sand. And once you crossed that line.
Once white hats and...
Once you crossed that line to the other side,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm,
no matter what you were, no matter who you were.
Did the management at Port Ship include men who had been on the line or had been
yes.
welders or whatever before?
Yes. Did they promote them, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes. They promoted them, and once they crossed that line,
yes, of course. Well, they're management
right.
after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's union mentality.
The union management relationship. What was your sense of that while you were there?
I never seen a contract. Never seen a contract come apart. So I didn't think that
test,
it was. Yeah, I don't think it was any problems there. There was no strike or anything there that we can recall. There wasn't too many disputes of anything. It was a job that, because of the lack of supervision, foremen, assistant foremen, not being around, and the yard being so vast, that a person was set by themselves to do the job totally. 100% of the time,
yeah.
No. So in saying that, was there reason to complain about your job? Probably not. I mean, if you didn't, if some one of the union foremen were on your butt, well, you just didn't do the job to what they wanted you to do, and it was left to them. The company would come down on them,
mm-hmm.
and how is one guy going to watch over 50 welders.
Yeah, sure.
That's a tough job.
Well, I'm sensing, inferring from what you're saying, that there had to be a fair amount of trust in the employees to do a good job.
Absolutely.
And that
yeah.
the workers responded accordingly. Then they did a good job.
Absolutely.
Generally speaking,
or not. Did or did not. Either. Yeah. So
mm-hmm.
It depended on. I guess work ethics, and it depended
yeah.
on if the foreman was a good person or not,
mm-hmm.
or the assistant foreman was not,
right.
and the jobs that you got.
If you didn't have a foreman breathing down your neck when you were busy welding, especially at night, I suppose,
well,
out there.
Well, yeah, you're freezing, and if a person's yelling and screaming at you, you're not doing your job fast enough or efficient enough, well, what would you do? Human beings are human beings, right? And it
yeah.
only takes so much from a person like that, that's like that, you know? So, I mean, the work conditions were brutal. They were brutal.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would never happen in this day and era. I can't believe it would.
You think even 30 years, as recently as 30 years, there were work conditions that are, to turn it around, you're saying literally you don't think that...
No, I don't think that the work... I don't think they could function that way with safety, with the way that safety and health and safety is nowadays.
Yes.
I work in the field I work in now, with health and safety, they can almost shut a company down because they're not following certain standards. the standards at the shipyards of that 30 years ago? No, they weren't up to humane standards. No, not at all.
What large places did you work at after Bombardier?
After Bombardier, I worked
in... Or was it still Cancar at the time?
Yeah, it was Cancar.
Cancar, yeah.
After that, I worked construction.
Mm-hmm.
Various, Link Steel, Dominion Steel, Coastal Steel. I was working as an iron worker.
Right.
Yeah, a welder.
Member of a different...
Well, different union, yeah.
Iron workers include welders.
Yeah, so I did a lot of buildings around town here, some bridges, and then out of town, mm-hmm. different places. Shutdowns and mills and a lot of mills and dirty jobs.
Paper mills.
Yep, I worked at paper mills. I worked at a few shutdowns here in Marathon Terrace Bay and,
right.
and Dryden.
Another subject, but not for this tape, I
guess.
Yeah. or this card. Yeah,
that was interesting work.
The work could be seasonally brutal as well, I guess. You did work winters, in the wintertime, I guess, on some of them?
In the shipyards or?
No,
in
later.
Oh, yes. Yes, later, yeah. yes. Oh, yeah, in the middle of the winter. I was up in I'm sure you're aware of it, in Manaki.
In Quebec?
No, Manaki up.
Oh, yes, yes, beyond Kenora.
Yeah, in...
Manawaki, sorry, was the name.
You've probably been to that establishment, Manaki.
I don't think I ever have been.
Have you been there?
And much of it's burned down now, I guess.
Is it now?
Mm-hmm.
It is,
unfortunately, the lodge is gone.
We were up there, and we were. I was with Coastal Steel. We had a contract, and they were putting up condo units. They were putting up units for the workers, for the service staff and waiter staff and all that. And it was like a small hotel for them. And so we were putting a wrecking the steel up there, and we would stay in one of the lodges there. And yeah, it was quite the place. Eh? It was beautiful. They had a theater in there, a golf course. It was right on the Winnipeg River, but that was in the middle of the winter. And was it cold? Well, it was cold there too, yeah. We were erecting steel and up on the steel in freezing cold weather. Everybody was going inside, and I remember me and this one older fellow, we were out there, I don't know why, but we stuck it out for a while. Pouring methyl hydrate down, I remember pouring methyl hydrate down an air hose, trying to keep the air hose going so the air gun would go. Because it would freeze up if you couldn't tighten the bolts up on the steel without the air, and so the air would freeze up. So you'd have to take your methyl hydrate and pour it down the lines. And so we stuck it out though.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Man.
Well, there was a time, 100 years ago and more,
mm-hmm.
maybe I don't know how much less, when work largely stopped in the winter time because of the brutality of it.
Yeah.
I mean, Montreal shipyard or a port, for example, would largely shut down.
Yeah.
The big warehouses in Winnipeg, I think, were built in part in order to get stuff to the prairies.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, the trains would still be running, I guess, aside from blizzards stopping them and so on.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I think there's two factors there I can see. Is one is the human factor, that that things don't on your hands, things don't work well in those extreme temperatures. But the other thing is it cost effective for a company to continuously be replacing things that break in the cold? Because some things aren't supposed to be running that cold temperatures. So when things keep breaking because of the cold, doesn't pay off, I don't think.
Yeah.
Especially airlines and, you know, all kinds of things bust.
I wonder if the establishment of unemployment insurance about 1940 will have been a factor at all, because before that, I guess layoffs were layoffs, but once the system was established, and of course it was built up during full employment war years, mm-hmm. then in a sense the state has a stake, certainly the Unemployment Insurance Commission, taking in the premiums, has a stake in people working year-round if possible.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that impacted work patterns so that winter work became more common.
Well, I'm not sure.
No,
but I can tell you this, that I'm very grateful for that.
Unemployment insurance?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Without unemployment insurance in those days, what would have happened?
Kept you going through the summer.
Well, sure, it did. It paid my rent, you know, wherever I was living.
Yes.
It gave me some income.
Sure.
And back then, they didn't they didn't really bother you to look for a job or nothing. You worked so many weeks and you got yeah. your unemployment to, you know, seasonal work.
Sure.
But grateful for that? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
In the 60s, winter works projects began to be developed to maintain employment
right.
in cities.
Right.
So that would
right.
certainly be another factor, and that's the federal government without doubt.
Well,
those winter works projects.
Well, absolutely. That's how I went through college, through the unemployment insurance program. The winter work project was one of them. They sent you to school and paid you while you were going to school.
I see.
Yeah.
So that was how it Confederation. How long were you at Confederation College?
2 years for that.
2 years,
yeah.
Learning welding.
Well, it was a little bit upgrading,
mm-hmm.
and
sure.
then I took. What happened was I took a radio and television and hi-fi technician course. But I don't like math, and Angus MacLean.
Conservative minister. In the
No. He's
was that?
different person altogether. He was a teacher at the college.
Oh, I see. This is a politician.
He came to me and said, "Yeah, it's not working for you." And I said, "Okay." So I transferred over to welding, and that's where it was. That's right. So it took off there. So.
There was a limited amount of academic study required to be a welder.
Right. Right. There wasn't no math of figuring out. And there was some blueprint writing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you know, most of it was just hands-on.
Work. No schematics in this.
Well, there was
not much
schematics. No blueprint writing, but no schematics.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so the
steels, properties of steels, and things like that. But there was no figuring out of math, because that wasn't my forte.
Yeah. How many different kinds of metals did you learn to weld? Or how many kinds of metals can be welded successfully?
All mild steels, for sure. I can braze.
Braze meaning?
Well, that's a torch. But they're even getting out of that with the brazing rod.
Mm-hmm.
You put fenders and things like that on cars and
So there's of course the electric and the acetylene,
right?
And you were learning both of them.
Yeah, I can do both. Yeah, and then I'm a good solder. I can solder copper well. I have no problem with that. Some pipe, I did some pipe, but I didn't get into the big pipes like chromoly and tungsten and the different alloys as much.
Mm-hmm. Question
I wouldn't mind asking a question.
By all means.
Jody, what makes a good welder as opposed to an average welder?
Steady hand. Steady hand, yeah. Eyesight, very good eyesight. As I've noticed, my eyesight has gotten worse. I don't see the puddle. They call it a puddle. I don't see the puddle as well. So that puddle is very important. It's like the paper. I relate it to the same as a painter's brush. If you were a good painter, you would probably be a really good welder. Steady hand. Your hand from here to the end of the rod, and the rod is here, so it's the tip of that rod is what you're looking at. So if the rod is 16 inches long from your hand to there, that steadiness has to go from there to there. And if it's shaky,
so if you,
it's not a good weld.
If you break the bead,
you break the bead, you're in trouble. It's going to look like heck, and plus it will cause impurities in the weld.
Sure.
And impurities in the weld is, that's not a good welder.
This is where the porosity
comes
in.
Right.
So I've attempted just a little bit on the farm with my father, and it's so very easy to break the connection. You know,
yeah.
the hand isn't steady, but when you...
What's
the term when you strike the arc, and then keep the hand steady so that the rod is melting into the crack.
Right, and back in those days, the welding helmet that you had, they're not like the welding helmets now. So you put your arc, you put your rod at this place, at the two pieces of steel that you wanted to weld together,
then
you closed your helmet down and strike the arc, because you couldn't strike the arc before you put your helmet down, because you get a flash. But the helmets they have now, you can put your helmet down, as soon as you strike the arc, it goes from darkness, it changes the lens inside. It's an automatic helmet.
It's the lens.
That's night and day.
You
don't have that that problem of starting the arc.
Yeah.
It was tricky. It was a little So that's an interesting question, though, because, yeah, I would say it's the steady hand. I would say that the abilities to maneuver in tight positions, you know, yeah, things like that. Because they would stick you in some positions. I remember one spot on one of the boats that you couldn't put your helmet in there. You couldn't get your helmet into the spot. You could just barely get your arm in there and the rod in there. And so they had a helmet that was made up of all leather with a lens in it. So you could get your head in there, but you couldn't get the helmet in. So you had to stick your head in there and the rod in there and weld in that spot. So it was very tricky.
Yeah.
I remember that.
I hope it wasn't a very large area you had to weld or a long
It wasn't. it was a vertical in there. I remember welding it in there, yeah. So, but
one can't, trust if you do. You can't weld upside down, I guess, or overhead.
Overhead, yes.
You can?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's the hardest position.
Yeah, I would imagine.
That's the hardest position to weld, but yeah. And then there are two types of welds overhead. They call it the fillet weld, which is in the angle.
And so it's then, a right angle and you're
yeah,
coming in at
yeah,
the,
you're coming in, you're welding
into
in the corner,
right angle. Right.
And then the other one is the butt weld, right? The two pieces
right.
together.
Two
so
pieces
you weld
right
them
in
there.
There.
Right? Yeah. Which this one is the harder one.
Would be the harder,
yes,
I would think.
Yeah, it's harder.
Yeah, if you're actually you're trying to form a bead overhead to join two pieces of steel, that's got to be very difficult.
The fillet weld is a little easier because you can usually rest your arm, your body against this wall, right? Where if it's two butts together, there's not much to rest against, so you have your arms like this. So in that instance, your arms are exhausting.
Yeah,
exhausting.
Because you're not, and you wouldn't be able to lie on anything either.
No,
wasn't the scaffolding. You.
Now, sometimes you could do that. But you might get burnt a little bit. But most of the time
because
it was straight overhead.
Yeah, flying in every direction. But the only shielding is the hand. You'd have a glove on.
Oh yeah, good gloves.
Glove on
yeah,
the hand. You'd have to have a glove on.
It's all leather. You were all dressed in leather.
Because the leather would sort of shear off the.
You would burn the leather for a little bit, yeah. But leather was, you buy your leathers from. One of the shops in town, and I remember what shop that was, Canada Welding or a place, but you would buy them there.
A lot of leathers ended up off animals onto welders, I'm sure,
and then the leather only takes so much after it gets burnt and too much, and you have to get new ones.
Were you ever tempted by pipeline work,
or no?
Was that even a possibility?
Well, I don't know if it would have been. It might have been, but I got out of the construction trade because I wanted to have kids, and I'm glad I did. I'd seen my kids grow up, and my friends that went on with construction. Yeah, they probably have oodles of money, but I can imagine what their lives are like.
Yeah. You went to construction or off construction?
I took off construction. I went off construction.
So what did you do after that then?
I drive truck for a living now.
Oh, I see.
In town, though. No. So
sure.
In town, yeah, for a company in town.
So how long have you been truck driving?
26 years.
26, then.
I'm going to retire in
19, back to about 86?
Yeah, 86.
Oh, so you had a welding career of...
both
7 years.
Well, there's a lot in there.
Well, yes, obviously.
Quite a bit, but I'm going to retire in 3 years, and then I'm going to do something else.
Sure.
I'm building. I build gates, the wrought iron.
Oh yes. Sure, that's the kind of construction work you're in, but it's
in
your backyard or wherever.
You see the twist in there?
Yes.
In the gate there.
So
metal gate.
I
have a machine that twists it.
I see.
Cold twist it. You can twist a square piece of metal stock in half almost.
So you're a consumer of construction, of structural. Well, what do you call this?
I have a creative
ornamental
mind.
Steel.
Ornamental steel. That's
ornamental
what it
steel.
I have a creative mind. I like to do some things like that.
So the whole arrangement for your.
Oh no, not that top. That's bought. I mean, just the gate
so
work.
It's the
gate work. Yeah, that's all this stuff. But you can do all that stuff.
You could have if you chose to.
Yeah.
I suppose China or wherever it comes in cheaper, and you could probably build it yourself.
Yeah.
Well, among the questions that were approved by the committee once upon a time would, what would you like people to know about the work that you did primarily, I guess, at Port Ship, those 3 or so years, I guess, that you were there?
What I like people to know, the importance of the importance of that industry and the other industries that are around that the local consumer takes for granted when they go to buy their clothing, when they go to buy their food and things like that. They believe that, a lot of people believe that it materializes on the shelves automatically out of thin air.
Yeah.
And they don't see the process behind the other stuff. They don't see that those boats are coming across or filled with grain and they feed the world. They feed the world.
Yeah.
Basically, all goes right back to the farmer, doesn't it?
Of course.
Yeah. It's right to the farmer. Yeah.
You know? Nature growing.
Yeah.
Growing the grain, and so on. But
nobody thanks the farmer.
No.
Yeah.
So you were conscious of your place
now I am.
In the...
Now I am. Back then, no, I wasn't.
But you would like people to appreciate the fact that a great trade goes on through this port.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're saying.
This town was built on that. This town was built on that. My grandfather helped build some of those elevators. Yeah, my mom told me that.
I see.
Yeah, he built that trestle that used to go across Memorial Avenue.
Yeah.
Built that.
Steep rock the iron ore dock and so he was an iron worker.
I don't know what he was classified as, maybe just a laborer. But
or maybe it wasn't unionized.
Back then, riveter, riveter was the initial welder, wasn't he?
Yes. You didn't deal with any ships that were riveted, I guess it was all welded.
Well, there was rivets on them, but in the disassembling of the boats.
Mm-hmm.
Western Metals.
We hadn't talked about taking them apart. Thanks for reminding me. We should. What's involved in taking a ship apart?
Gash and slash. They just slashed the poop out of the boats with big torches. We used to use 4-foot torches, and they were run on propane because propane is cheaper than acetylene. It's not as hot as a fuel, but it did the job well. So you had a 4-foot torch, and you just They just went to cut. They cut chunks out of the boat and just keep whittling it down.
And you didn't worry about taking pieces of steel out along welds. In fact, I guess you'd avoid the torch on welds because it would be more difficult. Or am I wrong?
On welds? No, it doesn't matter. It would just go right through. It cuts right through. You cut through everything. Mm-hmm. A lot of lead-based paint, it was all lead-based paint.
Yeah.
All of it. And so, were you burning that? Yeah. Absolutely.
Were you wearing face masks or any protection there?
No, that was all outside work.
Yes, it
all
was that.
Work, yeah.
Not always a much of a breeze, I suppose.
Did you breathe a lot of that in? Yes. And then they'd take chunks of it, they'd work to the compactor, and they'd cut it all up and cube it. And, and he and Mr. Schaefer, with his big cigar in his mouth, he'd sell her off there. He was a character.
Was he now?
Oh, yes, he was.
What was his first name?
Maybe it was Paul Sr.
Was it Sam?
Sam Schaefer, yeah. That's exactly what it was, Sam Schaefer. That place has gone through hands a few times, but he had a thriving business, for sure. And so,
And you were involved primarily in removing the structures. Well, you get down to the engine. What happened to the engine room?
Yeah, I don't know. He would salvage. He was a salvager, he would salvage. He would split everything apart, right? All your coppers, brasses, and he would split it all up.
Sure.
I mean,
for recycling, so to speak.
Different prices to different metals, right?
Yeah.
I collect copper myself. I mean, copper's $3 a pound right now. I mean,
worth finding.
Why not? I mean, it's money. You take a battery in now, it costs give you $10 for a battery.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy work.
It is.
Yep. So I mean, and that's what he would do. He knew all the prices of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was a moneymaker, for sure.
How many ships were you involved in taking apart?
Just the one that year. Just the one I did. And it was an all-winter job,
Remember which ship it was, actually?
Oh, no. Yeah. No, maybe in Algoma. Maybe Algosteel. I'm not positive which one it was.
Out of St. Marie.
We were taking it over. We were taking it apart, not at the yard. He had it docked over on the side closer to Abitibi, the old Abitibi, out that way, where the new Bombardier, or the new Bowater mill is. And then a dock on the side there. So he was taking it apart, and the crane would pull it off, pieces off, onto the ground. We'd cut it up in sections.
Oh, so that's where you were working, not just
at that time. And then I did work. I did also
not very far
yard.
From Cancara, am I
yes,
right? That's
yeah.
where the old yard
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I worked there too.
Right.
Both places, yeah. So, cutting steel.
I think the world famous place for ship disassembling is in India somewhere.
Is that where they do it?
I've seen pictures of the ships, which I guess have just been run ashore.
Yeah.
And so there it stands out of the water, and they start pulling them apart.
Yeah, recycle the steel.
Yeah.
Well, send her off and melt her down. Take all the impurities out.
It is dangerous work as well. I mean, asbestos inside and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, you've mentioned lead.
It's worse than manufacturing for sure.
Yeah.
For sure it is. Yeah. But I mean, it was part of the trade.
What might interest or surprise people most about the work that you did, as a welder?
What would interest people, the size of the scale of those boats.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see that, but when you're up close like that and you see all that,
yeah,
like the hulls of those the holding tanks, that held the grain. If you were to stand up on top of one of those and look down inside one, they're just huge. They're so massive, and that's where all the grain and then to see that filled with grain. How much is in there? I think the size of things like that, and to be able to walk underneath one of those and not be crushed was pretty cool.
No, that's really cool. You mean under the ship?
Right underneath the ship, you could walk. Yes. We could walk from one end to the other.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't.
Not too many people have been able to do something that have done that.
The joy of being a member of Parliament is that you end up in a lot of places most people aren't, and so I don't remember. I've been in the dry dock, and I can't be absolutely certain that there was a ship in there. I certainly remember all of the timbers and so on and so forth. So the question is,
have you been?
Whether there was a ship there. That's the question. In my mind, I'm not certain.
We never, ever, they were never fitted for salties, for ocean goers,
because
they were at flat bottom. The salties they have the keel.
Right.
So they weren't fitted for that. I don't know.
The canalers are, I guess they're flat partly because you want to get the maximum capacity going
through
with a sill at what, 23, 26 feet or whatever,
yeah,
I guess.
Whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Depending on the time,
the canal.
Yeah. Depending on the weather, it depends on everything, I guess, how much water they put in in the ballast.
Yes, how far down they want to push it.
Yeah.
What are you most proud of in the work that you did?
I probably would say the construction of that. With John B. Eyre, it was a big thing for us back then. I remember that,
Certainly, we moved to town in 78, so I got to town just about the time you were going into Confederation College,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, probably.
On this program and so on.
I would think that's probably the thing that in my welding career, at shipyards, it was probably that, for sure.
Sure.
Interesting. You know, that's funny, though. When you're that age, did I really think of that? Of that.
And you were doing a good job in getting your pay.
I was getting my pay. I look back at that now and I think,
yeah. Were you single through all of that period, if I may ask?
Yes. Yeah.
Family came later.
Yeah, family. I didn't marry until I was 26 or something.
Yeah.
A little later in life, yeah.
Well, you know that your work contributed to Canada's success as a grain trader.
Well, that's nice to know.
Since you referred to that earlier, I thought I would almost
nice to know that
pluck the words out of your mouth.
Did something.
Changes came to the industry, changes came to... did you experience changes at the time?
At the shipyards?
Yeah. Or during the year at Cancar?
At Cancar, yeah. They were always changing. The Cancar was a more progressive company. Bigger company. They were always upgrading things.
The port ship was very traditional.
You could see the downslide of that company.
Yeah.
There was no money going back into it.
So one of the things that happened in the '80s was the workplace health and women's. Workplace health and
women's course?
Put the words to it. The workplace health and...
insurance. I think it's insurance.
Is it insurance?
Women's.
Safety?
I should know that because...
WHMIS.
MIS.
Did you experience it? That was after your...
But back then, no, there was nothing there.
It came in the mid-80s, I'm quite sure.
It goes back that far, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, certainly by 1990, guys were talking about WMIS courses and designation of hazardous material. Workplace Hazardous Materials Information System, that's what it is. It's not health, but it's hazardous materials
information system. It probably would have crippled that company.
Well, it would mean a matter. It'd be designating all the materials.
Well, they would either keep up with that, or they would hold. Whether they had enough money to back it, I don't think they did. There were a lot of the times there were talks of barely keeping the place open.
Poor ship was certainly struggling in those days, as other shipyards would be in time.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the great privileges of being critic for shipbuilding in the NDP caucus, 85 or so through 88, was that I visited a number of shipyards across the country, from Vancouver to Halifax, actually, and visited them, and stories I'd love to tell, but not on the tape now. Interesting things I saw. But I visited Collingwood and Port Weller, as well as this one, of course, and Port Weller is in business. Collingwood is now a resort community, a retirement place, and Port Chip is a lot less than it was.
Yeah.
So there's been great changes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Where are all the Lakers being built now?
Well, there are so few.
There are
so much fewer required, given what happened with the Western Grain Transportation Act, which came after your time as well, and other changes which shifted the grain movement to the West Coast very largely, so it was more rail that was
more
involved
rail,
The lake traffic. I suppose it would be interesting to have a list of the Lakers registered in 84 and look at that list to see how many of the ships were still in service and what happened to those that aren't. Some of them would be CSL, Meisner's.
Patterson's totally out of there.
Patterson's was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the people we interviewed was Robert Patterson, who was the last president of Patterson Steamships.
Right, he's totally out of that now,
Challenges? Any other challenges on the job that...
at that job? Challenges at that job?
That we haven't mentioned?
No, I can't. I can't see of any other...
You've mentioned some fair number. Or challenges to the grain industry, now that all of that came to you indirectly, building the hopper cars at...
That's something. I went from one to the next.
Yeah, water transport to land transport.
Yeah, but did I think of that at the time? No, I didn't think of that at the time. But it's pretty interesting. That's how that.
Yeah.
How that come about, eh?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. And that's how. That's how important the grain industry was to this town, eh?
Yes. Well, you were building those hopper cars that this was what about 80. Three?
Yeah, so around 84.
83, 84. Yeah. When, in fact, the old Crow's Nest Pass Agreement, or whatever form it took by the early 80s, was under serious consideration.
Oh, yeah.
There's a book written by a participant in this from the federal government about how they work to end the Crow, basically, and replace it with the Western Grain Transportation Act. And so... here were hopper cars still being built in Thunder Bay at a time when that system on which the federal government was financing the construction of cars to make it easier for the railway companies to operate within the Crow rate regime was under. So there were changes and challenges taking place that were at a higher level.
You were working
at this level of building the hopper cars. I wonder... who was Minister of Transport at the time? Jean-Luc Pépin was the Quebec-based minister who was in charge of this attempt to change the system. Yeah. And so it's the book is very interesting in his endeavors.
And Bombardier was a French-owned company, right?
Well, Bombardier certainly is Quebec-based.
Yeah,
Tancar, out of Hawker Siddeley is probably Montreal-based as well, for that matter. Yeah.
I don't remember if it was called Cancar or if it was called Hawker Siddeley when I worked there.
Cancar would be the oldest title, with Hawker Siddeley controlling Cancar for a time, and then eventually they turned it over, sold it to Bombardier.
Oh, okay.
But in between, of course, is that Urban Transportation Development Corporation, which government did that come out of? Was it the Davis government already in the early 80s? Yeah, that would be provincially conservative.
Yeah.
So there were changes and challenges taking place around and about, but you did your job as a good welder.
Yeah.
Most vivid memories about the job?
Vivid memories about the job. The learning part of the job, the different technologies that I got to learn on the job at shipyards. I enjoyed welding steel and things together, but when I got to be put on different special jobs, like submerged arc jobs and different jobs like that in the engine room, things like that, I got interested in that stuff. I liked to watch that. Like I was telling you about the prop and those things, and I enjoyed that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Novelty.
Yeah.
I suppose something new.
Yeah, so those were fascinating job, things like that. The overhead cranes running on two tracks. That's
mm-hmm.
like 75 foot tall. And that's the backbone of the whole shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
It is. It's just the backbone.
Sure.
It does everything.
The equipment that it makes it possible to move things around and so on.
Absolutely. Those are vivid memories of me. Watching that guy walk up there, and he had an important job.
Yes.
He ran that whole yard.
Yeah. You were never involved with an engine replacement or moving or anything of that sort.
No.
So I guess that could be done. Was the engine room under superstructures?
Yes, right in the back, underneath. The engine room was right in the back, underneath all the accommodations and underneath all the kitchen, and everything was right in the bottom, right in the bottom of the.
So you're not going to lift that up straight unless you remove all of it. So
no.
Once the engine is in there, it's really in there.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, they take it apart. They would have to take it apart piece by piece.
But
if you're working, they're working on the shaft and the prop,
Mm-hmm.
It was all on the outside too.
Yes, well that's true enough.
Yeah, and then the bow thrusters at the front, because
mm-hmm.
they have the bow thrusters to push to turn the boat whichever way they wanted to turn
mm-hmm.
it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting too.
Yes. Yeah, learning about a ship when you first go into port ship and on a ship and so on would be very interesting
mm-hmm.
in its own way.
Well, for some people, I guess some people just take those things for granted. They see. Oh, there's a nice boat out in the harbor,
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Thoughtless. Almost thoughtless. What, do you have any thoughts about the most important events that happened in the workplace during your career? Admittedly, it was short enough that maybe...
The important event for me would be that, when I wasn't there at the time, I had just finished there, would be that...
That explosion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just
it must have happened.
Could have been me.
It must have happened around 83 actually, was it? Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
Of course it was in the news immediately this
the
accident at Port Ship and so on and so forth.
Could have been me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could have been any one of my friends or anything and I look at that now, it didn't have to happen.
No.
It didn't have to happen. I don't know the circumstances, but they probably whatever they did to
and your suspicion is that that the workers themselves were responsible.
My suspicion would be that, whether that's reality, I don't know.
Yeah. In a regime in which the company closed an eye to what was going on, and
it's possible.
In terms of substance abuse.
It's very possible.
So there wasn't any testing for drugs or anything.
Nothing
that sort of taking place at the time.
Most of the places now, there's no testing for drugs. They're trying to get into that until. Kinds of into the mining field, they're starting to do that now, which is they should.
Not a long time ago.
It's just rightly so. We're losing young men.
Yes.
Unnecessary. We're losing fathers are losing their sons, mothers are losing their sons because of things like that.
So perhaps the oddest at first blush, but then not surprising at all when you begin thinking about it. So I understand it when Prohibition came in late in the war years,
mm-hmm.
The teens of the last century, mm-hmm. among the people who became quite supportive of it were union leaders who found that sober union members were much more clear-headed and militant than they had been when they could drown their sorrows.
But them and the suffragettes, right?
Well, the suffragettes come a little earlier, and there is, of course, a connection, certainly in Canada, between the women's temperance union.
They were sick and tired of losing their men into the workplace.
And other things. I was in Toronto a couple of weeks ago in the Delta Chelsea again, and the last time I was there, I guess I realized that across the street on Girard, across Yonge Street, rather, is the building of the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Is that right?
It's still there. If you're ever in the Delta Chelsea, look up to the east, and you'll see the name across the front and WCTU on the side of the building. Now, I haven't really taken the time to go over and look to see how it's being used, but there it is, half a block from Yonge on Girard.
So from that time that all took place to this time in our day in life now, has it changed that much? I don't think so. Has it changed that much?
What's the it that you're meaning? Substance abuse?
Substance abuse in the workplace, with unionized and everything. Has it changed that much? Somewhat, but I don't know.
Impression we've had from some of the interviews that we've done is that there has been a significant reduction in, say, the elevators. We think, admittedly, there are far fewer men in the elevators these days, or people working, and so on and so forth. But, or am I wrong, Owen? You've listened to the interviews.
I can't answer that. I just know I was working in the federal government, and it was cleaned up in the 80s. Oh. Yeah, it was, you know, what drinking there was on the job did not exist in the 80s. As for the elevators, my father worked in the elevators, and he was one of the few folks that didn't drink.
Okay.
And it was always kind of an unspoken reality that, you know, if you worked in an elevator or some other dreary spot, they drank to get through the day. But my sense is, the nature of the work population has changed here in Thunder Bay as well. That, you know, because there are, as I already said, fewer people in that industry, there's less drinking just by the nature of the
population.
Yeah. Not necessarily per capita, but
the total. Yeah, that's right. But I don't know.
That would be the answer to that one, though.
Same with university professors, for that matter, too. Oh. I remember in the 60s.
Well, they certainly smoked it a way they don't now. Smoking is certainly a lesson market.
That's something I feel more comfortable commenting on.
Yeah. Do you feel it's important to preserve Thunder Bay's grain trade history?
I think history is important in itself to preserve, not just the grain trade. I like history. I love history.
Is this a love that's developed over time, or did you always feel that?
I think I always felt that. It was one of the only things in high school that I ever took an interest to. I never finished high school, but I
lost yourself as a history professor here.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, do I find it interesting? I wouldn't be sitting here with you if I didn't.
I guess not.
Yeah. No. I wouldn't have took into display that you had there.
That's right.
And my wife was off doing something else, but that's the type of person I am.
Of course, that's where we met. We might have said that somewhere earlier on the tape, I guess, that you and I met this summer of 2012 when we were, when the Friends of Grain Elevators, our partners of the Lincoln Social History Institute, mounted a display about the grain trade down at the Water Garden, Mariners Hall, I guess we can call that part of the building. Yeah. And you and I, you came in to see it, and I was sort of standing by.
That's correct, yes. And I found it quite interesting, because I started to look at the pictures of the people that were on that board, and I knew some of them, and started
the
to
people,
read
the people, others we had interviewed.
And started to read some of their stories and stuff like that, so I was interested. And then you asked me to do that, and I thought about it for a little bit, and I thought, you know, why would I be doing that? But then you just asked me that question about the history part about it. I think it's important for people to know about those things. I believe it's important. Mm-hmm. Whether they believe it or not, I don't know. But I mean,
only those who have a desire to learn will, of course, go and listen to these tapes.
Yeah.
But those who want to learn will then have a much richer learning experience because of what you and others have contributed.
Absolutely. I think that's important. To know where you come from, how you got here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there any questions that you would have asked if you'd been sitting over here at my side and interviewing yourself?
About the work that I did?
Well, in relation to the grain trade and the small or in the large, any questions that I might have asked?
No, not from the past, but I just wonder that, I wonder sometimes that, was everything done to protect that industry in Thunder Bay, in this area, to preserve that industry? Because it seems like it was just, or is it just a time of the, is it just a sign of things to come? Mm-hmm. You know, like the way that it's all taken place now, you know?
Yeah.
You know, at one time this whole area was grain elevators. They were all over the place. And now is it? So I don't know that. I don't know.
We've gone through two terrible declines anyway. There may be others. Some of them might cite others as well, but one is certainly in terms of terminal elevators. There are far fewer. There's far less movement through the port.
Mm-hmm.
The other would be the forest industry, but the pulp paper mills. That's, of course, quite a completely different story.
Right.
We won't get into at all, although I'm becoming interested in that story as well these days. The repeal of sections of the legislation for the Wheat Board, the ending of the monopoly the Wheat Board has had on movement, particularly of wheat off the prairies, is probably the change in 2012 that is of greatest interest.
Yeah.
And I was listening the other day to someone commenting from the Port Authority, I think, on the, it seemed possible from what he was saying that the voluntary operations of the Wheat Board now, farmers have had to sign contracts with the Wheat Board if they wanted to have the Wheat Board handle their grain, that may be moving more grain through Thunder Bay.
No.
But I mean, that's a very interesting proposition, that a voluntary arrangement could bring more grain back through this port. I don't know whether we're certain of that yet, but that would be the current change. And the citizenry, of course, just, you know, they watch things happen. They can't affect them and so on. Whether the city of Thunder Bay can have much impact on the grain trade, I guess, is the kind of question that you're hinting at.
Yeah. I think that, well, that's my own speculation. I won't go there with that one. But, yeah, that's about all, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I would ask you. I mean, you asked most of the questions you need to ask.
Yeah, I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
We want those memories out.
Yeah. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
I hope so, for sure.
Well, I think, and did you have any other thoughts about questions?
No, I enjoyed the interview immensely.
Good.
Yes, so did I. Thank you for coming in.
Okay,
I'm glad that I did
it.
I'm glad that I did it.
Well, I'm glad you stopped by, and I'm glad you said yes, and I'm glad you've done this. Thanks very much,
Jody. Thank you very much, too.